Hey, I'm John.
I'm Eric.
And I'm Kevin. And I'm going to present my piece here on art and technology, which I think is crucial for the older generation to become acquainted with as technology is changing all the time. I think it's important for you to acknowledge a milestone, if you will, a noticing of the influence that art and technology began to have. Roy Ayscott noticed this in the early 2000s, and he coined the term moist media, which he felt was a land between the moist, or the wet, that is the human brain, the cells, the organs, and the dry, that is the analytical and the computer software. He coined that term a little bit too early. There weren't actually a lot of artists that were working in the medium that he had envisioned. His view is more of a long future view, where biology and technology merge together. This is pretty wild stuff into like smart archaeology and architecture and such, and a little
almost like living art was his
view. Yeah, essentially, oh, wow. Is this is his future of it, but. That I don't know if he kind of called the milestone off in the future, but it's still important to acknowledge it as it did coincide with a big explosion of internet technology at the time.
Yeah, I can see how people would take that introduction and have it introduce them to their own weird ways of thought and kind of have it influence their art, maybe their own version of moist media. I'm sure it definitely started something.
And then you know, with that advent of the internet and the ease to which we could have downloads, we did encounter some troubles with technology and music, mainly the act of piracy.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Sinclair, and Todd Green basically boil it down to four individuals, four music connoisseurs. You have your Steadfast Pirates, your ex-downloaders, your mixtapes, and your old-schoolers. Traditionally, in his study, their study, they found that old-schoolers tended to purchase all of their albums, whereas a Steadfast Pirate would be eager to steal. Now, the reasoning behind those actions are completely different. The Steadfast Pirate would do it to be anti-industry and kind of thumb their nose at the music biz. Whereas an old schooler is doing it more to support the artist themselves, to make sure that that artist is actually going to receive some money. And oddly enough, in the study they found that most older people associated with the old schooler, the traditional buy the music and support the artist, not so much the industry. Some of the benefits that have come from the act of technology integrating with art, we've been able to find a lot of benefits from art and autism, the use of sound media and visual media being made easier for an autistic person to use with tablets and iPads and such. There was a study done in the Department of Psychology in the University of Massachusetts in Lowell, 2014, in which they had 16 autistic kids get together for, I believe it was an nine-week period, in which they would conduct different experiments, not really experiments, but more social activities for the ASD children. They did a lot with the use of iPads, which have shown a real solid use in the school systems. And now, I wasn't able to actually find what level of ASD there are, and since it's not such an easily quantifiable condition,
indeed.
They did find that 10 out of the 16 kids had made friends through the process, which of course any adult can tell you it's not easy to make friends. So for an ASD child to make friends over this activity was pretty impressive. You know, I thought
is a good rate.
I thought it was pretty nice. But ultimately, this all also boils down to an issue of generating the art. You know, what can the art world get from the technology? And we have seen some more technological art exhibitions in recent years. One of my favorites when doing some research was an interactive global crisis art project, Dataplex, which was the art project of Michael Teiko Mardo, who essentially made an embodiment of the 2008 financial crisis that people were able to interact with. It would have been unique. I wasn't able to, unfortunately, find anything on it, but it just sounded like a really fun, interactive art piece to take part of, especially if your numbers were falling there.
Yeah, art being such an emotional medium, grabbing that particular emotion for people who did relate to the stock market crash, people who were affected by it, it would have been powerful.
Yeah. I mean, all in all, from what I've gathered, is there's no going back. Is that we're going to have a convergence of the art and the technology, and both the means of it reaching the audience and its generation. I think older folks would be wise to embrace this new change, to accept painting with an iPad and to give it a try. I think this is there are some novelties to the antiquated ways of doing it, but I think that technology is making it a lot easier for older folks to get involved with.
And certainly at this time, bridging the gap between technology and brush to canvas, they're getting closer.
Yeah.
Every year they seem to get closer. So I like that advice. Maybe just give it a try. You never know. And if your medium reaches more people, maybe that switch was worth it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. John, you have any questions for Kevin?
No, yeah. You do a good job of telling us what you got, and I feel comfortable with the information you gave us.
Yeah, I learned a lot. It also made me think about how my own views of art was someone who graduates with an art degree. I have some close friends who did. I never was sure what they might do in career paths. Some of what you just talked about, especially that work with the autistic kids, tells me they have a lot of career path options now, especially with the ways that art's being used with technology. Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Certainly.
Awesome. Well, great job, Kevin. Thank you for your time and information.
Mm-hmm.
All right. All right, Eric here back with John. John's topic is going to be internet privacy. What is it? What? There four, was it?
I think so. A little bar.
No, I only play it maybe. What is this? Okay, it's Eric back with John, and now we're going to talk about generational views on internet privacy. John, take it away.
All right. So what I want to start off here with some few percentages that I found that I thought were pretty interesting. The first one is 63% of parents with teens ages 12 to 13 say they're very concerned about their child's interactions with people they do not know online. And I feel like that's a big problem, since, you know, parents are pretty much great deal protective about their children. So
yeah, that stretches back to before the internet was a big influence on our generation, the millennials, right? I can remember my parents saying, well, who are you going to hang out with? And if I don't know them, I don't know if you want to hang out with them. And I'm sure that transition into the internet just, if not magnified it.
Oh, yeah. I feel like it definitely magnified it, because with the internet, there's such a huge possibility of just so many different people that, like, all over the world. And, you know, like, back in the day, you should be, like, people in your neighborhood or, like, other cities around you, but now you got to worry about, like, whether it's...
Absolutely, you don't know who you're talking to, yeah. I guess. You don't know who you're talking to, and the ease of finding someone to talk to online, it is outstanding. So,
yeah,
I guess I could totally see why someone might be afraid of who their kid's talking to.
Yeah, definitely. And to go with that percentage, I got another one here. 59% of parents with teens that have social network sites, they have talked to their kid about their concerns on their profile or account. And I think that's, you know, that's a start to get, you know, your children to be thinking about online privacy, maybe help them and, like, set them in the right direction to be safe, since not a lot of little children may know, like, what to do or what not to do online. And to go with that, I got a thing here I thought it was pretty interesting too. 60% of teens say they have created a account on social media without their parents' consent or their knowing, and I feel like that might be a concern too, because if you're doing stuff behind your parents' back, you know, that's not a smart thing to do, because
that's a considerable correlation. More than 60% of the parents are concerned about these anonymous individuals their kids talk to. 60% of kids say they made a second profile. There is a correlation there for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, just...
So, John, how would you summarize generational views of online privacy?
Baby boomers have a restricted perception of online privacy, because only 13% are using social media, according to Kevin Murnane of Forbes.com. And of those 13%, they did not grow up with it, unlike millennials, who have been dealing with the pressures of online privacy since its inception. They have a good understanding of balancing personal interaction and online networking. My generation, however, has never had life without online interactions. So we lack the benefit of face-to-face communication, but we also excel in generating information and feedback, concealing ourselves from harmful online material, and the ability to unify as groups for major cultural issues.
That's true. You only have to look at the March for Our Life movement or the Me Too movement to find evidence of our country's youth excelling in today's online culture. Well, I certainly learned from your segment, and I hope others can too.
Yes, thanks for having me. I hope people use this information to spread understanding throughout friends and family. I'm John Wirth. I'm here with Eric. Eric will be telling us about the generational views on video games.
Specifically, video games and their effect on violence, health, and socialization.
So, if you ask me, John Wirth, I would say that video games are the greatest thing ever, period.
Agreed.
But what about our parents and people younger than us?
Well, I think it's a really easy misconception that when you're growing up with video games, if your parents disapproved, you just might assume that the baby boomer generation or anyone that age just doesn't like them or has a negative view on them. With my research, I found out that that isn't correct. So I found that the fastest growing demographic for gamers happens to be women aged 40 to 50. This was in a 2011 study, but that also remains true through 2015. I also stumbled across a survey by the HuffingtonPost.com. They have a member section for only 50s and up. They call it the Post 50. This year, they sent out a survey to their member section. Over 1,800 people replied, and over half of those 1,800 replied, they said they were actively gaming at 50 and up. So the idea that the older generation doesn't find it entertaining or they have a negative view on it was just a misperception.
So you said you mentioned you wanted to talk about health earlier. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, again, people might have the wrong idea about video games and its effect on your health. So one, it's true that if anyone has a very sedentary lifestyle, if they sit around and they're not active, you will feel negative health effects. The same for if you stand in front of a screen, sit in front of a screen, you're gonna feel the health effects of the blue light that those screens put out. Now, if you're watching TV in front of a computer or playing a video game, there's only so much blue light your body can take before it starts affecting the magnesium inside your brain, before it starts building up a headache, before it starts dropping your eyelids. This is a natural thing, and this isn't caused by the game itself. It's being caused by the type of light from the screen.
So there's a lot of misconceptions about health and video games. One thing I can think of that could be kind of good is I've heard people talk about it helps your hand-eye coordination. Have you found anything about that?
Yeah, I definitely did. So for someone to think that your brain on video games is kind of like an egg going into a frying pan, it doesn't seem to be true. So these action-packed video games have all these stimulation points and all these areas that you need to be keeping track of. Your communication, your movement through the game, for these first-person shooters that are so popular. It's where are your teammates, where are your enemies, how much ammo is left in your magazine. All these different points that you need to keep track of has improved people's organization, and it also improves their hand-eye coordination because they're keeping track of these multiple objects on the screen. And the best example I can provide there was a case study by Daphne Bavalier from the University of Geneva. She works in the Geneva labs, and she's a neuroscientist. Two studies they would conduct. One, they would flash a number of moving objects on the screen. For a small moment, they would have them change color, and then they would when they would freeze the screen, they would pick out one of those small objects, and they would ask, did we change the color from this object back and forth? The example, they would change it from blue to yellow to blue. The average human being can track 2 to 3, max of 4 of these objects at a time. Individuals who play lots of video games, the action-packed ones in particular, they can track from 6 to 8 objects at a time, doubling how much attention span and how much hand-eye coordination you're using. I think that's a pretty significant shout.
So there's a big controversy nowadays about violence in video games, especially in the media. Can you tell me anything about that?
Definitely. With so many school shootings, it's really easy to say, hey, is this a topic that needs to be addressed? Is this a reason why people think it's okay to commit a school shooting or a mass shooting? So again, the argument is you need to test these things in labs to have a hypothesis tested. If we all use our own experiences, then it's all just, it is just that. It's our own perception based on how it's affected us. But if we put this in a lab and test it, we can get down to it. And when they did that, they found that exposure of a violence game does not make an individual violent. If you give an already violent individual extended exposure to a violent media, regardless of it being video games, movies, what have you, that will increase the amount of violent action and behaviors they show. So it's violence for violence's sake, in my mind. It's not transforming the brain of people into a violent or criminal individual.
So personally, I've been accused of being addicted to video games. Is that true? Can you become addicted to them?
No, you can't. According to a study by Rune Metzoni of the University of Bergen, there is no correlation between the addiction area of the brain and that which is stimulated when we're playing video games. It's actually more so that video games are so fun compared to the rest of our lives that we tend to let our mind wander towards them during our other tasks. We just think about them so much that we might even consider ourselves addicted. But there is no correlation between video games and addiction.
Okay, and I got one last question for you on our segment. How are video games going to affect Generation Z?
So the Z generation is going to be affected by video games, in my opinion, in two key areas. The first of which is going to be networking. Like in your segment, we described how the internet is connecting these young individuals in a whole new way. Video games are no exception. when they meet individuals from other geographic areas of our country, they get to hear about their perspectives and see their points of view and know their way of living, which is just helping individuals become more rounded and more empathic. They're using more empathy in their thought, and it gets them to know more people a lot easier. It's easier to find like-minded and like-interested individuals on these platforms. The second way I think the video games and Generation Z are going to mix is gamification. According to Gabe Zickerman, who is the co-author of Gamification by Design and The Gamification Revolution, as well as a few other pieces on gamification, he said that when working with children inside a gamified curriculum, you ask them, why is it working? And their response was, A, it's multiplayer, it's cooperative, and B, it's fun. So if the Z generation can hone and master these gamification techniques, get them into schools and workplaces across the country, we will increase the amount of cooperative fun we have in training and learning about each other and our opinions.
All right, thanks, Eric, for joining our podcast. I hope some people are able to take away your information and change their perspective on video games.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. And I also hope someone changes their mind about video games.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.